Today's program was brought to you by Brooklyn Ball Factory, a Japanese eatery and coffee shop in East Williamsburg, with a new location opening in Hell's Kitchen. Learn more at bkballfactory.com.
This is Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Douglas Diaz, who was a professor of architecture at Columbia University and now a full-time artist. I met Douglas while I was on vacation in Japan last September. Douglas has truly unique experience of living in an area called Higashi Yoshino near Kyoto, which had suffered from decreasing population. And today we'll talk about Douglas' fascinating stories about living in Higashi Yoshino to become an artist, his culinary discoveries in Japan, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as iTunes and Stitcher podcasts. Please go to iTunes and Stitcher and subscribe to Japan Eats. Also, if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japaneats@heritageradionetwork.org. Now let's start our conversation with Douglas Diaz. Hello, Douglas. Welcome to Japan Eats.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for having me.
So, it's kind of weird that we met in the middle of the village in the Higashi Yoshino last time, but you're back in New York. So,
yeah, it's such an interesting contrast to see people in a village remotely in the mountainside of Japan and then in an urban setting. It's a little bit bizarre.
And especially because you're from here, New York.
Yes.
Right? So
yes.
What's your background?
So I was born in New York to Dominican parents. And I was born, which is very strange, I guess, for people to live in Brooklyn and be from Brooklyn. and I grew up largely in Brooklyn, but I did travel a little bit to Dominican Republic, Venezuela, and always New York was my home, probably until I actually left in 2013. And it was the first time that I made, I think, as an adult, a conscious choice to go live somewhere else and not just vacation or spend a few months, but to completely relocate.
Right. So before that, you were teaching, you were majoring in architecture. And then you've been teaching and doing a lot of work.
Yeah, so I lived in California for a few years to go to undergraduate, and then I returned to New York, which is kind of the pattern. and I went to Columbia University, and then shortly after that I started teaching. And eventually I did a whole lot of different other things, working for an advertising firm and all these things. But everything always related back to design or something creative. And then in the late fall of 2013, my girlfriend at the time, we went to Hawaii to get married. And from there, I was doing work in Japan, and I always was in and out of Japan for many different reasons. But at that moment, once we got married, we ended up in Tokyo. And we made a choice to go to Nara because it was Golden Week. So part of getting out into the countryside.
Right.
And it was really fascinating because we were on Airbnb trying to find a place in Nara.
Right. So for listeners who are not familiar with Nara, Nara is I would say 1 hour train trip from Kyoto or Osaka. And it's, I think, the oldest imperial city in Japan.
And it also has this reputation for being a very spiritual place. Some of the largest Buddhas and some of the most sacred temples are in Nara. So part of Golden Week, which is this incredible celebration that is largely based, I think, on a spiritual platform, but is also a time where Japanese people usually go back to their home.
Right.
Spend time with their family.
Yeah, the Golden Week is like, I think Japanese people work too hard, too much. That I think one time Japanese government created a whole, you know, the consecutive national holidays. So in May, so people travel, like Thanksgiving on here now.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And we were on our way there, and my wife at the time, she had looked on Airbnb for a place in Nara, but Nara Prefecture, when you search in Airbnb, is almost the same as Nara City.
Mm.
And we found a place in Nara Prefecture, which is basically the equivalent of New York State versus New York City. and we ended up in a place that was an hour and a half away from Nara City. So that was an adventure to get out there.
Right.
And that's how we ended up in Higashiyoshino.
Okay. Yeah, I know exactly because I stayed at the same Airbnb last summer. But it's really remote. It's in the middle of the mountains. And I heard if you go up to one of those mountains, you could find 400-year cypress tree. But yes. Now old people, like really old guys, only knew how to get there. And they all died. So it's kind of... You can approach them.
Yeah, and it's really fascinating because the town itself, Higashiyoshino, is... Well, Yoshino, the county, is known for its sakura.
So
it really gets an incredible amount of tourism, especially around the cherry blossom, which is what sakura is. Mm-hmm. And in the springtime, it's just a really beautiful place to be.
Nice.
And Higashiyoshino is kind of like this... hidden jewel within Yoshino. And like you said, there's many trees that are completely untapped, but now I think it's all starting to change because they're planting trees that are really grown for cutting and exporting as opposed to the way the Japanese have traditionally left the hillsides untouched.
Right. Well, too bad. Hopefully it's not going to be too much.
Well, it's a really interesting problem because the population is decreasing, so
right.
I think nature will take over.
In a way, right. He's also speaking of the population, it's only 1,700 people in the village, right? So you stayed at the Airbnb, and then what happened?
So at the Airbnb, I had this very kind of quasi-mystical experience where I met Kasu-san, or Sakamoto Kasuyuki, in the Sakamoto family, as you did as well.
Mm-hmm.
And his English, which is not perfect.
So he owns, actually, the Airbnb with his family.
With his family, yes. Family. And his wife is Kuniko. Mm-hmm. I call her Kuniko-san and Kasu-san.
Mm-hmm.
She's the one that speaks English much more proficiently. And so she kind of makes all the arrangements of Airbnb. And then if you would have stayed longer, she would have probably asked you to help her with making arrangements for foreign speakers, as she did with me. but I met them and completely fell in love both with the place and also their beautiful energy and just hospitality. And I went back to Kyoto after a few days. And in the middle of the night, I woke up and I thought, I need to go back.
Wow.
So I called Kuniko-san and I told her I want to come back, and they said, please do. And then I came back and spent another 5 days. But I went by myself.
But you were on a honeymoon.
I was supposed to be on a honeymoon, yeah. And I went back, and the next morning, Kasu-san knocked on my door at 5 a.m. and gave me a pad of paper and a pencil and said, draw. And he had no idea that I actually did any drawings or did anything of the sort.
Right. Because if you stay at the Airbnb of Kazu-san, you're basically buried in his artwork.
Yes.
Right. So the wheelhouse, it's like a cottage, and then you basically are really becoming a staying in a museum or something.
Yes, it's really interesting. They refer to it as the atelier. They spent 7 years in the 70s in Paris. So there's a lot of Parisian influences in his work and his kind of way of thinking and vocabulary. In fact, that he speaks better French than he does English.
Right,
And part of it is this incredible, as you were just talking about, it's almost like a cathedral to his work. It's a building that he built by hand.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and this section of the Airbnb is actually like a third. And then two-thirds is basically just a museum to all his artwork that he's been creating for 40 years. He paints every day.
Right.
So the house is completely filled with paintings everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think spiritually, it's facing a small river. So keep hearing that sound of, you know, running river.
Running water, yeah.
Right. And in the morning, you wake up with it. And it's kind of a, you know, meditating environment.
Completely. And the strangest thing is when you wake up in the mornings and you hear the river, it's this constant flow. But the river obviously ebbs and flows, but so does the sound. And I think it has a lot to do with the ability for most people who come visit to find peace and relaxation. And a lot of people, like myself, when they first go there, come with all these plans to go hiking, to go visit the shrines and all these things. And in the first few days, you just sleep.
That's what I did too.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah. So basically, you're inspired by all those artwork and meditative environment. So you wanted to start becoming an artist. That's what...
Yeah. After 5 days, it was this bug that just got into me. And I was on a month-long trip through Japan, so I had to leave. I had to go see the other places that we had made bookings for. And at the end of it, I ended up going to Europe for a while, and then I came back. And for that year, I just, every single chance I could, I would go back to Higashi Yoshino and spend time with them. They came to visit in Hawaii, and after dinner one night, we were joking that I should move to Japan, and Kasu-san said, yes, I'll find you a house. And it ended up being the house next to his. So I moved.
Wow. Okay. Well, there's another, and we're going to talk about it later, but, you know, that's decreasing population thing. There's another project. So you perfectly fit in that kind of, you know, the picture and their plan and your plan.
Yeah, it's they always have an ulterior, beautiful motive, but it's always repopulating Higashi Yoshino, which I think they were trying to get you to do.
Yes, I was trying, almost convinced to, you can do a radio show in Higashi Yoshino. I was like, no, probably not. Right. Okay. But so you don't speak Japanese so much, but how did you live and survive in a small village like that?
I think you're being very kind. I don't speak Japanese at all. I know about 30 words, enough to get me into trouble. You know, the thing about a small village, you mentioned it's 1,700, but the side of our village is about 180 people. People are just, and there's an older population. I think the average age is 70.
Oh, wow.
But most of these people have had some exposure to English. So there's a general kind of friendliness and an openness to, you know, to greet people and to engage. And it's amazing if you say konnichiwa correctly. It goes a very long way.
Wow.
But it did help a lot to have Kasu-san and Kuniko-san there because I relied a lot on them for most of my interactions, especially dealing with logistics and legal issues.
Ah, bye. And also, I think you told me that they're kind of patrons. Physically, they fed you dinner.
Completely. Yeah, I was completely spoiled. I mean, everybody thinks that I went to the mountains and had a harsh monastic kind of life, but in fact, I probably gained weight. Just ate delicious Japanese food all the time.
Wow. So because Kuniko-san is a good cook too.
She's an amazing cook. And it actually is, they take a lot of pride in cooking. So the entire family is incredible chefs. Everybody cooks. Everybody has a specialty that they cook.
Oh, wow.
So throughout the week, cooking duties rotate. But Kuniko-san, I would say, probably carries the most amount of the work in terms of cooking.
Right. When I was staying there at the Airbnb, a couple of times she brought some really delicious traditional Japanese food, and I was so thrilled.
Yeah, she did the same thing to me the first time I was there, and I never ate any of the things that I bought. I ended up just eating with them all the time.
Oh, wow, that's great.
Yeah.
So basically the Sakamoto family, they have 3 sons, and then 2 live with them.
Yes.
Right now.
So. So the 2 sons that live there is the older son, Daisuke Sakamoto, and he has something called Office Camp. He's getting married. Is that okay to say in the air? Anyway, he's moving to another atelier that they have. Mm. And the younger son, the middle son, Takeshi, lives with them and basically does everything around the house in terms of cutting wood, preparing meals, taking care of their financial life. Right. It's an interesting kind of family structure.
Right. And he himself is an artist. Yes. He draws only dragons, I learned.
Yes, and it's around Nara. There's you can see some of his work in temples, and it's quite fascinating. They're a very creative family. And the youngest son, who lives in a city nearby, has a coffee shop, but he makes lighting fixtures.
Oh, wow.
He has very, very beautiful work. Mm.
Well, let's talk about that, you know, the office camp that you mentioned that the cousin's oldest son does.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating... they're a very entrepreneurial family in general. And Daisuke moved back. He was living in Osaka, which is the prefecture next to it, but also a very large city. I think after a certain amount of discontent and maybe even getting a little bit sick of living in a big city, he moved back to Higashi Yoshino, and in that process stumbled across one of the biggest problems that Japan has, which is the depopulation of the countryside. Mm. And so he's created a really beautiful, it's a physically a gorgeous space, and it is it basically serves as a hub to attract younger populations back to the countryside. Mm. And at the core of it is a coffee shop, and it also has a meeting workspace, so sort of like a shared office environment. But in a very traditional Japanese style, it also has a series of sleeping spaces, tatami rooms in the upstairs. Mm-hmm. And that's been growing in popularity, so now he's traveling around Japan, showing this model of how to attract younger people to the countryside. He's received funding from Tokyo, from Nara Prefecture, so he has a lot of support.
Right.
It's an incredible space.
Yeah, I actually visited the space too, and then it's very Japanese, but you can think of, you know, Brooklyn shared space, kind of office space.
Completely.
And Wi-Fi and modern. And
it's very good coffee.
Right. And it's just really a good idea to rejuvenate the place. And then, yeah, because I think the purpose is there's no corporations. So you have to bring in entrepreneurs and artists and those people who can create jobs.
Yeah, I mean, the Japanese countryside is fascinating because industry has been leaving. Mm. And with it, the younger population leave because there's no work. Mm. Not everybody wants to be a farmer. And so the problem of how to bring back youth to not only rejuvenate the place, but also maintain traditions and cultures. So, but in a classic twist, it is modern at the same time. It's not just very traditional. Mm. So it's a thing that I found really fascinating about Japan is anything that is sustainable in Japan is rooted deeply in this history, but then embraces technology, embraces moving forward. So it's a really beautiful balance. I think it's something very different from the West, where we tend to criticize our history and then we try to disconnect our history. Mm. In Japan, it's, you can't move forward without bringing the history through.
Interesting.
And so there's a lot of symbiotic relationships between history and then the future.
Mm. I think Japanese people, the mind, we have to succeed the tradition and not mess with it, and they have to build on top of something.
Exactly.
Know, right.
And it gives it a beautiful depth, which, you know, I think more things in the West could benefit from doing things like that.
Mm, right. So how successful was an office camp? I mean, I think it's still going strong.
Yeah, it's incredibly successful. When I was there, he has spent the last 2 weeks traveling through Sendai, which was deeply affected by the tsunami and earthquake and a few years ago. And one of the things that area is looking at is how to bring back youth into that zone to rejuvenate it. Mm. So he has spent some time cultivating this prototype and how to build it in Niigata, in Nagano. So he's spending a lot of time traveling through Japan doing it. So it's a really beautiful model.
Right.
And I'm probably not doing it enough justice for what it is, but it is a mixture of both support at the prefecture level, support at the city level, and then requiring a lot of young people to come. So in Higashiyoshino, since I've been there, the last 3 years, I think about 40 people under 40 years old have moved to the village, which is an incredible percentage given the fact that it only has 1,700 people.
Interesting. So, yeah, actually, I met a photographer, a comic book author, and any other artist kind of people. And one of them invited me to his house to just show around, like, 3 minutes away from the office camp. And he showed it. I think he tried to convince everybody, you can live this way. And I think for the 3-bedroom house, he paid only $250 a month.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's interesting because the new generation takes a lot of pride in moving to the countryside, and everybody becomes mini ambassadors to promote this new way of living.
Right.
That is stress-free, deeply rooted in nature, and it is I would say is also a very kind of creative environment to be in. It's very, it gives you a lot of inspiration.
Right, like the river on the by the cottage.
Yeah, exactly. But it is interesting that it is the creative force that's moving into areas like that. People who can work flexibly from many different areas, who need that space, both physically and spiritually to prosper.
Right, and you can, thanks to the internet, you can do anything, basically.
Exactly.
Right. Okay, let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about Douglas' favorite Japanese food in Higashiyoshino. So please stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Ball Factory, a Japanese eatery and coffee shop located at 95 Montrose Avenue in East Williamsburg. Behind its large steel doors, Brooklyn Ball Factory is brewing up some of the city's best tea and coffee. Grab a pour-over, matcha latte, or yuzu ginger mint tea. For lunch, Brooklyn Ball Factory offers sandwiches and curries. Or think inside the box and order one of their bentos, like meatball, grilled veggies, or pork shabu shabu. The meatballs, a favorite, are made with beef chuck roll and short rib in a sweet-sour sauce of apples cooked in soy. And did we mention the roof deck? After your coffee and food have been prepared, climb the staircase behind the counter to find an oasis in the middle of Brooklyn. Visit Brooklyn Ball Factory at 95 Montrose Avenue in Williamsburg and check out their new location opening in Hell's Kitchen. Learn more at bkballfactory.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japanese, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Douglas Diaz, who was a professor of architecture at Columbia University and now a full-time artist. Douglas spent the past 3 years in a small village called Higashiyoshino in Japan to become an artist. So now let's talk about Japanese food that you enjoyed in Higashiyoshino. So first of all, what did you eat normally in Higashiyoshino?
The diet in the countryside of Japan is quite distinct, I think, from cities, even Kyoto or Tokyo, in the sense that it's largely vegetable-based. And despite the fact that that Nara is landlocked and Higashiyoshino is deep in the mountains, you do get an incredible amount of fish, largely from the river. But you also get, you know, your typical fare that you would find in any... I guess in any part of Japan, you know, tunas and mackerel and so forth.
Right.
And what we, Kuniko-san, largely cooked most meals, and that's kind of, I think, standard for living in the countryside. There's not, you know, the closest store was about 45-minute drive. So you end up cooking a lot at home.
Right.
And also Kasu-san and Kuniko-san have an incredible knowledge of the plant life that is in the village. So a lot of times, depending on the season, we would go picking for fresh wasabi or different kinds of fruit. And I don't know if you remember, but on the property itself, they actually grow a lot of vegetables that then we consume. And then seasons as well, seasoning as well. So shancho, which is one of my favorite spices, is it grows right next to the house.
Right. So yeah, the sansai is basically mountain vegetables. Sounds like by hunting they had sansai and growing other vegetables like spices like a shancho, and that's pretty local, sustainable.
Yeah, it is. And they are. I found that most Japanese people have ingrained, or at least in the countryside, have ingrained a sense of eating within a certain radius. So the rice that we ate on a daily basis was grown by a local family.
Wow.
That was the father-in-law, the potential father-in-law of one of their sons. And, you know, so you get fresh rice, which is incredible. We would have usually the mixture of meal always contains some form of vegetables. And in the very traditional sense of Japanese culture, you always have something raw, something fried, you know, something from tempura, steamed, and then always some kind of rice at the end. So that was a very basic kind of food. But in the village, as it's a really, really tiny village, there was an incredible soba place.
Okay.
That I absolutely loved, and it's only open on the weekends. But it's probably one of the best sobas I've ever had in Japan.
Wow. So they only open only on weekends. So who's the chef? Do you know?
I forget his name, which is awful because my Japanese pronunciation is really bad. But they were a couple, or they are a couple that retired. They were school teachers up until about a few years ago. And they bought this house that is a... I think it's dated to be 400 years old structure. And they remodeled it, and they have a restaurant, a soba restaurant that only works on the weekends. And he's basically become a master soba maker. And I actually got to learn how to make soba from him.
Really?
Yeah, there's some really bad videos floating around of me doing that.
We have to find out.
And it's a really fascinating process, because learning how to make soba from start, from scratch, basically, you have to learn how to knead the soba and have the right combination of buckwheat and water. Water is very key, and it comes from the river. And so it's very cold, and it's perfect for making soba. But cutting, probably the hardest part outside of kneading, is actually cutting it really thin so that it's every noodle strand is exactly the same width, which would allow it to cook perfectly, because perfect soba cooks in 2.5 minutes. Which is not what you get when you buy a store-bought
soba. Right, not the dried noodles.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So he makes a batch on Friday night that lasts through the weekend. And so there's only a certain amount of dishes that he can serve. And that relates back to how many seats there are in the restaurant, both for Saturday and Sunday. And then whenever it finishes, it finishes. That's it.
Actually, when I stayed at Airbnb, Kuniko-san said, "Would you like to have soba?" And we got so much food in the fridge at the supermarket. Yeah. He suggested buy a lot, so we couldn't afford it. But I think I missed something very important.
Well, it's interesting. The restaurant has, I believe it's 4 dishes, basically zaru soba, and then a portion and a half of zaru soba, which is item number 2. Item number 3 is soba with duck. And then the portion number 4 is... zaru soba with duck and tempura. So the only basis of the meals are basically zaru soba.
Right. I think it's a kind of the test of the chef.
Exactly.
Right. There's nothing else to hide the flavor.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And one of his secrets for the dipping sauce is that he doesn't use bonito flakes, which is very traditional.
Right.
He actually uses fish stock.
Oh, wow.
And that changes. I won't talk about which fish it is because it's a secret thing. But but it actually changes the flavor entirely. And as you, I don't know if your guests know, but most soba you have a dipping sauce, which is has a dashi base. But after that is a series of other ingredients, and dipping this noodle is really key to the process of then eating the soba.
Right.
And then, of course, the other thing that he does is have fresh wasabi that grows in his backyard.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Right. It's interesting. I would imagine that dashi is based on ayu, the sweet fish from the river.
Yes.
That's my imagination. But
it's a good guess. The other thing that was my favorite food in Higashi Yoshino, well, is actually part of the town Haibara, where you come into the train station.
Mm.
I found this thing. Well, I didn't find. It's been there forever. and I was bought to the restaurant, but it's an incredible unagi restaurant.
Mm.
And like most unagi shops in Japan, they only serve unagi. So you can get unagi in many different forms.
Mm.
And the flavors are absolutely spectacular. The only place that's better, in my opinion, is the home of unagi, which is in Nagoya.
Mm.
But it's incredible. It's a family-owned restaurant. So mother and father own the shop, and then the kids work there. It's open every day except for Thursdays.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get lunch and dinner, but they limit the amount of
right.
seats.
And we almost went to the restaurant, but we ran out of time, so we couldn't go there. But you said it takes a long time because they make nagi after you order it.
Yes, right? it's not pre-cooked, which most places do.
Mm.
It's cooked three times, so it's broiled on both sides, and then the last, or steamed, broiled, and then broiled again. And then the sauce is added in the second broiling, so it really cooks into the flavor.
Right.
And then he spends a lot of time picking out all the bones, so it's a very elaborate and a very elaborate process.
Mm.
And okay. He also pairs it perfectly with sake.
Wow.
That comes from the region, because once again, Higashi Yoshino has incredible water. And then if you're ever there. The best time to eat unagi is at the end of June, beginning of July, because you get what they call young unagi. So it's much more supple. And he gets a very amazing batch of unagi.
Wow. Okay. So, but then basically that's almost the only restaurant, sounds like, around the station.
There's about two other restaurants. And they're Japanese take a lot of pride in meals and cooking, so they are a specialty dish, but this unagi restaurant is probably the key shining star of Haibara and of the region.
Right. So Haibara, I think it's about an hour and a half to Kyoto station.
Yes, if you take the express train, is about 45 minutes on the local train, which I've done by mistake a few times. It takes 2 hours.
Right.
And it's 40 minutes from Higashi Yoshino. So that was our Sunday night special meal, was to go to Haibara and get unagi.
Right. So Sunday treat.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So what do you think, you said regional cuisine is very different from, the Japanese, what people say Japanese cuisine in big cities. And, as far as you see, Japanese food in New York or, nowhere, you have family in Miami, do you think are very different?
Oh, completely. It's it's really hard to actually compare, and everybody tells me that I'm super spoiled for living in Japan. But the obviously, like with most cuisine, the freshness of the ingredient makes a huge difference.
Mm.
In Japan, people eat regionally, so they eat always local fare. So depending on where you are, you will have fresh fruit, fresh food from that region. In the mountainside, it's just really it's really beautiful because you get the full range of the seasons, and so your cuisine changes throughout the year. It's very hard to pinpoint. I think there's more flavors that are regional, even though people might share a similar produce or different rice or meats across Japan, but the actual seasoning changes per region. And then the mountainside is, it's based on freshness, and it's based on, how can I say, it allows the food to really become its own flavor.
Mm.
And so wasabi is used sparingly, so it's not something that overpowers.
Mm.
And with eating with them was just an incredible treat, because every meal was just cooked to perfection and it always had the right balance.
Mm.
The one thing, if you're not familiar with home-cooked Japanese food, you have to be careful how much you eat every single plate, because there's about 20 plates that come through in a little meal.
Right.
So at the first few months, I would always overeat at the beginning.
Mm. Well, I think 20 is far above the average, because Kuniko-san, that really like hospitality to you, I think.
Yeah. Right.
But I think number of the dishes, and as well as especially vegetables.
Yes, and everything is cooked in place on separate plates. So you end up having a lot of different little micro meals within the meal. And then the hardest thing, I think, as a Westerner was that at the end of the meal is when you eat rice.
Mm.
So just when you're feeling full, then you have this bowl of rice, which is exquisite because it is harvested one town over.
Mm-hmm.
But and it's very disrespectful not to eat rice in Japan.
Right, because I think a lot of us think there's a god in any single grain of rice. So.
Yes, and so you must eat every single grain that is served.
Yeah, so when I was little, I was told, until I finish, I cannot get up and do something else.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there's a lot of ingredients that Kuniko-san and Kasu-san will spend months laboring over and getting the right seasoning that they prepare. So there's an incredible amount of food that is prepared and dedicated, and energy that's basically just put into eating.
Mm.
It's a very critical part of their lives.
Right. Maybe because they spend some time in Paris too. They're kind of some passionate about food.
Yes, they are. And they do have, Kuniko-san was trained, if you will, in making microbiotic food in Paris. So I think that translates really well into Higashi Yoshino,
because
there's an incredible amount of vegetables.
Takeshi, the second son, was very sick when he was young. So it's kind of like natural and progressive movement in the family.
Yeah, and they, I think because of it, they really pay attention to whole foods, and it's not, processed food is very discouraged. And then, of course, you know, there's a lot of pride in eating local, which is really beautiful. And, you know, we spend more time discussing the ripeness of tomatoes from the region, or, you know, shiitake mushrooms, or, you know, you have to become an expert in food if you live in the countryside of Japan.
Well, I think we have a very good environment to be immersed into the real Japanese food.
Yes, and it's interesting because there's a lot of conversation that we had at the dinner table where food is not just about nourishing the body, but also nourishing the spirit and nourishing creativity. So I can't count the amount of times that we would sit and have two-hour meals discussing the benefits of eating properly and how that changes the creativity that you have. The one thing that I haven't spoken about is the amount of desserts that we have also within the Japanese culture, because I think as a Westerner, you always think about mochi or green teas or that sort of thing. And in Japan, there's an incredible variety of desserts, but it's a really beautiful rhythm of sweet, salt, sweet, and salt that continues throughout. And then you pair it with teas. And so it is just as elaborate as the actual meal. And it's a really beautiful balance. Which allows also for great conversations to transpire.
Do you remember one of your favorites or two?
I think it's called Anko.
Anko. Right, red bean.
Red bean
paste.
Which is interesting because as a Dominican, my family made desserts out of red beans.
Okay.
But it's not anything like this at all.
Mm.
So it was a really big cultural shock to all of a sudden be eating beans, and they're super sweet, sweeter than anything I've ever had otherwise.
It's natural ingredients, but I think instead of Western sweets fat, they use azuki beans.
Yeah, exactly.
For accent.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you spent all those great time in Japan, and how's your artist career developing?
Well, that's part of the reason why I'm leaving Japan, I think. In terms of creativity and inspiration, Japan is number one. And then so it's Japan will always be my spiritual home. But admittedly, living in the countryside in a village of 1,700 people is harder to have an artist career.
Right.
And I think maybe just for clarification, I make large drawings with graphite. So there's a very strong analog component to it, which becomes harder to sell, for example, from Japan.
Right.
And so I've had to travel both to exhibit, but also to then develop that part of the career. There's an incredible appreciation, I think, in Japan for creativity in general and for modern art. I think people get it. But Japanese homes, and it's not a culture of consumption the same way that it might be in the West, for example.
Right.
So,
because the box is smaller, so you can't put a large artwork.
Exactly.
Right.
So that's why I'm ending up moving to Bangkok. It has a very vibrant city life. But it shares a lot of, I think, the spirit of Japanese culture in the sense of how peaceful people are, how welcoming they are. So the notions of hospitality are very important to me.
Right. So you've now just moved to Thailand, and that's going to be your place to practice Japanese mindset as well as, Buddhist mindset, maybe?
Yeah, that's the challenge. One of the things that I've been looking at is that my work is largely influenced by Zen. And obviously between Zen and Buddhism is a very strong Buddhist undercurrent to it, or rather I should say the Thai version of Buddhism. So there's a lot of commonalities between them, but there's also significant differences. And one of the things that I've kind of sought for myself is the challenge of carrying Zen into an urban environment, into a city as developed as Bangkok is, where it has a certain amount of busyness and congestion. But one of the authors that I follow the most in Zen, he wrote Uchiyama. He wrote this this beautiful line where he said, "It's easy to be a monk in the mountains where you only have to worry about meditating. The problem is what happens when you go back to your life." And I sort of taken that as a challenge to say, okay, well, what happens when I go to the city? Worst case scenario, go back to the mountains in Japan, which is not bad.
Right. So, but what's your inspiration for your work, regardless of where, you know, like it's Zen mindset, you can practice anywhere, but how do you do it?
Yeah, so the one thing that happened when I was living in Higashiyoshino is through Kasu-san as an incredible mentor, my shisho, is that he really instilled the notion of, and this is something similar to Zen, is that within you there's the fountain of everything. The universe exists within you. And the question is, how do you tap into it? How do you clear your mind to not get distracted by your desires or needs or wants and allow the wealth of that exists within you to flourish? And how to tap into that. And that should happen regardless of the environment that you're in. But it also isn't about blocking it out. It's actually about being hyper in touch with your environment as a way to get in touch with the reality of life. So there's a lot of... we had the pleasure of drawing together in different environments. We've drawn together in Hawaii, in Osaka, in Hiroshima... and it changes everywhere you go, but really what's changing is how you interpret the environment that you're in. So being in touch with that is really key,
right,
both to my work, both to his, but also that's the basis of Zen.
So how do you do that?
I think so. One of the things that I think is problematic about contemporary living is that we preface our minds, we preface our intellectual development. And that starts as early as being a little kid and your parents rewarding you for memorizing names, colors, things like that. And then obviously being in an academic environment is, you know, that's the major reward in our society. We reward people who are intelligent.
Right.
But that comes at a cost of not being in touch with your heart and not developing a spiritual path, not necessarily a religious path, but a spirituality. Mm. And what I've worked on is actually quieting my mind to allow me to understand what my heart is experiencing. Mm. I like to say that the mind is really powerful and it produces a lot of imagination, but it pales in comparison to what the universe can provide. And our hearts are able to connect much more quickly to the universe than our minds can.
Mm. So you meditate, and that's how you get to the...
Yeah, so in a very practical terms, I sit every time before I draw, I sit, and it ranges between 10 minutes and 40 minutes of meditation, depending on how much baggage I have that day. And the meditation is a Zazen meditation, which means that you sit in a very particular posture. And the easy trick for beginners like myself is to count your breath in and out until 10, and then you start all over again. And if you mess up, you simply continue counting from 1 to 10. Mm. If you get to 14, you know you're not meditating, you're now thinking.
Right. Interesting.
And in the process of doing that, what happens is you start to, at least for me, it feels like this energy is rising. And it comes through to your heart, and it basically fills your heart up, or it fills my heart up. And then what I try to do is not visualize it, but just be in that presence of that energy. Visualization is very difficult, especially for me as a visual artist, because I don't want to draw an image of what that emotion is. I want to draw the emotion itself. So I think of it as allowing the energy to fill up to my heart, and then when it reaches my arms, then I try to move my arms.
Right.
So before it goes to my head, because once it goes to my head, then I start thinking, am I angry? Am I happy? Am I sad? And I'm no longer meditating. I'm thinking.
Yeah, meditation is very hard. I am trying to practice, but sometimes, you know, the noises in your head is hard to get rid of.
So this is a key, very, very good point that you're raising. In Zen, you would say, don't get rid of it, because the act of pushing it is a thought. Just don't follow it.
Right.
So the book that I quote the most from, and that's been a large inspiration, is called Opening the Hand of Thought. And I just was very fortunate to meet one of the editors of the book in Hawaii, a man named Tom Wright, who was a disciple of Uchiyama. And his lineage of Zen is a very powerful one. And the book is called Opening the Hand of Thought, which basically means, like the clouds in the sky, you allow them to pass through. If you try to hold on to them, then you're thinking.
Right. So you're aware, but you don't do anything with it.
Exactly.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So that's great. And did you practice Zen meditation in Higashi Yoshino in the first place?
Yeah, I started maybe more seriously in Hawaii. But when I got to Japan and Higashi Yoshino, I was able to go a lot deeper, both because the environment allowed it. I carved out the time.
Right.
But I also had the pleasure of meeting a Zen monk who happened to be my same age, but oozed, I guess, wisdom. And I was able to do a little bit of practicing with him and kind of deepen my practice through that process. And Zen is a very fascinating thing in Japan, because most of the population would say that they don't know anything about Zen, but they live a Zen-like life, because it's so deeply embedded into the culture that there is no separation. Of course, those things are becoming now more infrequent, and, you know, Westernization of Japan is really a very strong phenomena. But Zen is rooted in the consideration people have towards each other, towards the environment. So it's a really powerful, even eating. I mean, most of the meals that we ate were not unlike what Zen monks would eat. You know, you don't, even though we have fried foods every once in a while, it's largely based on steamed cooking or things that were prepared raw, which is much more like what Zen monks would eat.
Right. So just like the mindset of the meditation, I think we tend to accept what we are given and be grateful for any kind of food at the table. So maybe that's a part of Zen.
Yes. And I love, even that expression, itadakimasu, right, which is a thanking.
Right.
Everything from the plant, the sacrifices, the people who've cooked it, the serving, and then the people who you're sharing that company with. It's so, at its core, that's what Zen is about.
Mm.
It's both accepting, being grateful,
right,
and being in harmony with your surroundings.
Mm. That's the harmony, yeah.
Yes.
Right. Okay, so this is the last question. So before we started, we had a conversation about your art, and then you said, art is not a career, but the way of life. So can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. I think, maybe it's because I just came back from Art Basel in Miami, where there's an incredible amount of systems put in place to create art, and it's become commodified in so many different ways, which is, you know, not bemoaning the fact that art is an object that can be sold, but it has become a way of producing a career, producing a body of work that you do almost as separate from the way that one lives. And what I learned in Higashi Yoshino is that if art is a way of life, then the way you eat, the way you sleep, the way you talk to other people is a form of art.
Mm.
So the time that you spend making the work is not separate from the time you spend, for example, eating.
Mm.
So Kasu-san really emphasized the fact that when you're an artist, you should have different times to do different forms of art. Mm. In the mornings, you work until sundown, never after the sun goes down, and you take enough time to actually have a life, which means how you eat, how you spend time with other friends, your family life, and having a balance in those things. And
right.
That to me is a way of life, as opposed to the career driven model, which is you set out goals and then you try to reach them.
So your art is an extension of who you are. So you have to build yourself to make
exactly.
a good art. That's very deep.
Well, it becomes a really useful tool when you want to deepen a practice. It's very difficult to deepen a personal practice if you don't have a certain amount of devotion. But the devotion is both an expenditure of energy,
right,
and you can't expend purely energy. You have to be able to regroup, reestablish your foundation of energy, and then be able to do that again. So it's really critical. One thing that I talked to him a lot about is how much do you expend of energy, and do you let energy sit and build up until you do it again the next day? So that's a very different model than the way I was educated in the United States, where you just work as hard as possible until you basically drop, which
right.
is what's happening in Japan in the city.
Right, in the modern countries, in a way.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, but you have to allocate to build on top of something.
Yes.
Important. So, okay. So, hopefully you can come back on the show again.
We'd love to.
Right. So, okay. So, good luck with everything.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the opportunity to talk to you about my food obsession.
Well, thank you for sharing really profound thoughts.
Oh, thank you.
So, thank you for coming. All right, so listeners, if you'd like to know more about Douglas activities, please visit douglasdiaz.com. That is douglasdiaz.com. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, or suggestions for guests or topics of the show, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org. And Japanese is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, and Stitcher podcast. And please go to iTunes and Stitcher and write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Our engineer today is David Tatasiore, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. and we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.